This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the first time. The First Time Podcast has a newsletter. It will go out monthly-ish. To sign up, go to our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com, and click on the Sign Up to Our Newsletter link. Hi, Kate.
Hello, Catherine.
Guess what we're going to talk about today?
Tell me what.
Preface this by telling you about a conversation I had at work recently.
So
we have there's probably 600 or 700 people at my employer.
Yeah.
And we have canteen.
I love
special
this.
Special canteen. Yeah, it's actually really good. Their food is very good. Anyway, so I was waiting in line for the canteen for the coffee machine and a guy came up. Don't know him that well. He's actually very nice. I'll preface it by saying he's very nice.
Will he be listening to this?
No.
Because it could be awkward.
No. He said, how's the book going?
Ooh.
I said, great. And he said, have you sold many copies? And I said, it's going well. And he said, but you're still working here.
Ouch.
Yeah, he is actually a nice guy.
Doesn't sound very nice.
But wow, after we chatted, I did go back to my desk and start Googling. My Google searches were things like, most annoying questions you can ask authors.
I've never Googled this.
Yeah, I like to feel like other people feel the same way as me.
True.
I found a list.
Great.
So I thought we could go through them and see if we do actually both hate the question and
okay.
Why.
Awesome. I feel like we may disagree on some things, but let's
yeah,
it'd
do be
it.
Interesting to see. So first question
yeah.
is, and now this has sort of a couple of different ways it can be interpreted.
Mm-hmm.
Either how much money do you make?
Mm-hmm.
How do you make money on each book?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know how many books you've sold?
Mm-hmm.
Thoughts?
Thoughts. Okay. So I think I have a couple of different responses to this because I think I felt differently about this when my book first came out
yep.
as opposed to how I feel now.
Yes, right.
So I think when your book first comes out, I was really sensitive about how many books I'd sold or whether I was making any money off them because there was expectation, my own, everyone else's, like the person who asked me if I was going to renovate my house when I had an advance. You know, like, no, I'm not because do you know what an advance is for a literary
fiction?
Because
that's probably part of the thing is you have to contextualize.
You have to contextualize it. So I like the how do you make money question because generally I use that as a myth-buster thing that writers don't earn any money and, of course, we have to work in other areas. So I'm happy to answer that one. And yeah, how many books we've sold, I'm now much more open about. I loved when Jane and Annabelle came on in season one and just flat out gave their numbers.
But you know, I was thinking about that because they flat out give the numbers of their own books, which is, you know, great. With most of the, or my interpretation is that Annabelle had done a blog series where she had data from people and not a representative sample necessarily. Yeah. She's very open about all of that. But it's still anonymous data within that. So I'm transparency. But there's also part of me that, like, I think about, I don't know, I run tenders and different things for work. There's also, you know, how open are we in other sectors of population?
It's true.
You know.
And which is hard because anyone in publishing or in books knows your figures because they've got Nielsen book scan.
Yeah, how does that work?
So they can bring them up at any stage if they've got book scan. So they know them.
Yeah, right.
Other authors don't and people who aren't in the book industry don't. So that's also the thing because I've thought that too. Like, oh, maybe I shouldn't say that if I'm looking for an agent. Yep. On the other hand, an agent
can
just access my figures. So not sure. Interesting. But I do think it's something to do with time. And I think also I wonder with Annabelle and Jane, for instance, if you lose that feeling of stress or coyness or frustration around your first one, once you've moved on to your next book, because that's like done.
Yeah, true.
You know, so maybe. Well, how do you feel?
I guess to me, because I have, you know, you don't have royalty statements and those sorts of things yet.
Yeah.
So it's a question you sort of can't answer.
You can't answer. You actually can't.
But it also feels a bit like, on the one hand, it diminishes, and my book is a commercial book, I get that, but it diminishes the act of a creative act of writing into a consumer kind of a product. It sort of says, puts it in the terms of success as a business entity to be sold. And if you're going to do that, would you ask the same question of someone who has set up a widget store and is selling widgets? Do you know what I mean? Like you,
yes.
If you're going to approach it as the merit of this is financial, but I will not apply the same rules, the same social norms that I would apply to other financial kind of entities.
Although I think that maybe the people who ask,
I get that. I how many people ask that question?
Yeah, are the same who would ask that across any industry. Maybe. I don't know. I also wonder if it feels different depending on where it comes in the conversation.
I think I don't care if it's people I actually know. But I don't want to be asked at the canteen.
Like, no.
Do you know what I mean?
That's a very... And I think that that's very different. Also, you work in an industry which is entirely unbook related in a way.
Yes.
Which also gives it a very different context because people say, if I'm working in libraries or I'm teaching writing, you know, people ask... And I'm willing to hand over that information because they are people who want to publish books and I want to give them the information about how that happens.
True. That's a very different setting.
Okay, let's go. Next question. What's the next question?
Okay. Sequels, adaptations, translations and additional formats.
Doesn't bother me, this question.
No, it doesn't bother me at all.
No. Oh, and I think it's interesting to compare with people. Like, I'm interested to know how you got French translations. What does that look like?
Yeah, I don't see it as a... I mean, yeah, I would be interested to hear from other people.
Mm-hmm.
Can you introduce me to your agent?
I am a big fan of the introduction. I use introductions a lot. I have done them for people. And while I've never said, can you introduce me to your agent to someone, I have definitely had people do intro emails for me. I would say this though, I do that for people that I know and I know they're writing. So do not email me and say, can you introduce me to your publisher, etc., if I've never met you and I don't know your writing. Like, I wouldn't do that. So, no, if someone came up to ask me that and I didn't know who they were, I'd say bugger off. Well, I wouldn't. I'd say it in a nice way.
I'm the same.
What about you?
Exactly the same. I would happily intro to people that I know that I had some appreciation. I would want to pass someone on that I thought was
definitely
great.
And that's how kind of how the book industry works too, really. All right, go. I like these questions.
Have you thought about self-publishing? I've heard that's where the money is.
I'm going to say pass on how I respond to this question.
I always respond to this the same way. I mean, I was not interested in self-publishing. But I actually do believe that self-publishing can work for particular genres.
It definitely
can.
And
work very, very well. So fantasy, romance.
Yeah, I don't have enough information in this area.
Okay, next one. You're an author. Written anything I've heard of?
This is a funny question. And yes, I've been asked it many times. I think more difficult than this question is the writer's room kind of or the green room situation at writer's festivals when you maybe recognize a writer but you haven't read their book or you're introducing yourself and you kind of mumble, you know, I'm Kate and I wrote this book on Skylarking. And I think I've said this on the podcast before, but at Brisbane Writers Festival, I had this fantastic publicist, someone else's publicist, who interrupted a conversation to say, no, introduce yourself with your full name and say the book that you wrote. Doesn't matter if no one's read your book. Like, authors get that we haven't read other people's books.
You
and that's
do,
completely okay.
That is a great and generous thing for a publicist to
it
say.
It was lovely.
You.
Yeah.
I feel both sides of this. Like, I totally feel that awkwardness when I go up to someone or when I speak to someone and I haven't read their book and I feel like I should have read their book.
Yeah.
I also, when people say it to me, think, don't worry. Like, it so does not concern
it
you.
It doesn't
when you're on
concern you at all. No. This also changes depending on whether you've identified as a writer. So, like, how often now are you in a situation where you're telling people, oh, yeah, I'm a writer.
This is this transition I'm making now. So my daughter has just started prep. She's our oldest. and I'm having, you have a lot of new conversations with people you haven't met before. Yeah. And a very common question is, what do you do?
Yeah.
So for the first bit, I just was saying I'm an engineer.
Yeah.
But then I was like, internally, wanting to say more than that. Like,
yes,
I'm multidimensional.
I'm also a writer.
So now I say both. So I say I'm an engineer, I work here and I do this, but I'm also a writer. I had a book come out last year. I'm working on my
That's cool. And what kind of response are you getting?
Yeah, very good.
Mm, I like this.
But
we should have done an experiment.
It's a funny how you have that greater sense of ownership at a point in time. What do you say? Well, yeah, I just think it's the very secret kind of thing of
yeah,
say it as it is or...
Yes. I think that maybe I just didn't say it, and I have since had things in the car park where people are like, oh my gosh, you're a writer and you wrote, I've read your book, which is a lovely,
yeah,
a lovely way to do it, but I should have just owned it at the start.
Yeah. What are you trying to keep it a secret?
I don't,
that's what
yeah,
I'm saying
exactly,
to myself.
Exactly. Don't keep it a secret. It's it's foolish.
Stupidest thing ever.
Okay. Go.
Where do you get your ideas?
I love this one. Because I talk about it so much when I'm teaching writing. So I love that. Also, now most writers have done that to death because we have, it's part of the package of publicity.
Yeah.
Do you reckon? Like, what do you, do you like that one?
I just find this question bizarre. I have never, like, there are too many ideas in the world. Like, I can't imagine having a deficit. Not that they're great ideas. Some of them are terrible, but that's just not.
True. I think people are addicted to knowing the process of when something came into people's head.
Oh, no, I love that. Yeah. I totally get the story of where did this idea come from?
Yes.
But in,
or
that
where in general.
More yeah. in general do you get your ideas?
Yeah.
That's a question that I'm like, I could think of 10 ideas right now.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think it comes from
non-writers
or inexperienced writers. That's why I think young people ask it so much.
Mm.
And it's great to talk about the different ways.
I do love hearing people's, like, the origin stories
yeah,
of books.
I love origin stories too.
Understanding whether they start with a theme, a character, a, you know, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I love all those bits.
I like the what time of day type stuff too. Like,
where do you put your body?
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Yes, that's Anna Eastley's thing in Starving Artist. Like, how do you actually get through the day as a writer? Where do you put your body?
Yeah,
what I love that question.
Okay. Actually, that's it.
They were the questions?
Yeah.
Okay, I feel like they weren't so brutal.
No, they weren't. They were very kind. Really, I just wanted to talk about that sales one. That was the,
yeah,
that was my secret agenda.
And you know what? Maybe we will keep coming back to that at different points
and
seeing
then,
how we change.
Now I've had to interview a few people and send out questions. And now I do this, like, I have like a paragraph spiel at the end of the copies sold saying, you don't have to answer this, don't feel you have. Like, we've been asking everyone, but, you know, hardly anyone answers.
I love it. So your opinions actually changed from when we started the podcast before your book came out.
Skin in the game.
Now you've got skin in the game. And now you're like, ooh, this is going too close to the bone.
So, yeah, see what I say in 12 months' time.
All right,
I'll be like,
we'll come back to it.
150,000 copies, Trent Dalton.
Trent Dalton, exactly. No, he's a really nice guy.
I haven't met him. I've got the book.
It's a good book.
Just got to read it.
Exactly. All right,
that's it. Oh, we have a newsletter.
We do have a newsletter.
We're actually very, I'm excited about the newsletter.
Yeah, because newsletters are where it's at, apparently.
It's really where it's at. It's going to be a good newsletter. You can sign up for the newsletter via our website, which is thefirsttimepodcast.com.
Brilliant.
We'll see you there. This episode, we speak to Bram Presser about documentary fiction, Hommas, and Jewish punk rock. Scruffy Scrivener, semi-reformed punk rocker, recovering academic, occasional criminal lawyer, two-time cartoon character. After schlepping around the world for 10 years in the acclaimed punk band Yidcore, Bram Presser realised he was getting too old to sleep on concrete floors and smear hummus over himself every night. Swapping the rubber chicken for a fountain pen, he has since dedicated himself to writing. In 2011, Bram won the Age Short Story Award, and since then his stories have appeared in Best Australian Stories, award-winning Australian Writing, The Sleeper's Almanac, and Higher Ark. His debut novel, The Book of Dirt, was published in Australia in 2017 to wide acclaim and went on to win the New South Wales Premier's Literary Award for Fiction. Welcome, Bram.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Now, your bio has to be one of the most interesting of anyone we've met. You've done a lot of things. What came first?
You know what? I will say reading came first. Can I say that?
That is a good
answer. Because I always say that, like, before anything, I'm a reader.
Yep.
Right? Obsessively so. Writing came pretty early. I was writing, you know, already as a kid, but music was also something that I was very into as a kid. I still have photos. My parents kept photos of the concerts that I used to put on dressed as Elton John on my bed, holding a soap microphone. Age 23.
Yeah, they're so proud.
Yeah, I would have been out, yeah, 5 or 6. So, you know, I ran the gamut of performance types for my parents. But, yeah, I think music and writing were always together. And then, you know, law kind of, I fell into it, I suppose. Actually, I didn't fall into it. I really wanted to be a lawyer. And then I became a lawyer and, well,
yeah, what was the appeal of law?
That's a good question. A couple of things. Yeah, there's that noble pursuit of you want to, you feel that you are able to help people. And I had a particular, I practiced criminal law, so I had a particular focus on homeless and people with mental health problems. And in many ways, it was really, I suppose it was social work more than it was the legal work. You know, my friends who I went to law school with and who went into commercial law now are all sitting on yachts smoking, you know, hand-rolled Cuban cigars and whatever. But they hate their lives and I like mine. So, you know, there's that. But law is something that I enjoyed. I think I like the academic pursuit of it more. I stayed in academia for a while. But I think, like, writing had always been the dream. And the other good thing about, like, being in academia and doing law, it left me with a lot of time to do the music. So, like, the uni year is 6 months. So I had 6 months where we could tour and where we could record or that sort of stuff. So that was really handy. But when it came to, like, practice, I sort of decided, I'm okay, but I'm not that good.
You wouldn't want you to represent
you. Yeah, well, I just feel that, yeah, my clients deserved better. And so I thought maybe, you know, I'm an okay lawyer. I'm a reasonably good writer. So maybe I'll just, you know, focus on my strengths.
So you said that music and writing were intertwined.
Yeah.
Did you write songs, the music to songs, the lyrics to songs?
No, I am instrumentally challenged is the, I think, the technical term. I wrote lyrics. I had one guy, we were the Lennon and McCartney of our band, if Lennon McCartney had very limited talent and were never ever famous. But we wrote together since we were probably about 14, through to when the band finished when we were mid-30s. And we just had like this kind of really intuitive, almost codependency in creative, like, music creativity. And we just, it just worked. And I would have, he would come up with the chord progressions or whatever, and I would straight away get a melody that was catchy or something like we just got each other like that. And then I was writing lyrics, which was actually my favorite part, really.
So did they come first or did the music come first?
Mostly music came first.
Yeah.
I remember, like, our last album, we'd actually recorded most demos for most of the songs. I had lyrics to only a few of them, and I actually went on a holiday and I just took the demos with me, and I literally wrote all the lyrics to that album on, like, one holiday on the beach.
Yeah. And inspired by the song that you were then listening to.
So I would like listen to it and I would kind of hum a melody, get an idea of what I wanted. And then once I had the kind of rhythm of how the lyrics should flow, I would have an idea for a song, and then it was strangely organic, but it was always based around, like, a bad Jewish joke, usually. Like, that was how the band started, as kind of like a joke cover band of kind of terrible day school and summer camp songs that were forced down our throat when we were, you know, teenagers. But it then morphed into something like, you know, it was a Jewish comedy punk band, I don't know, prank band. Like, I always just say we were like Mel Brooks on speed or something like that. And it just kind of took on a life of its own. So it was always kind of, it was mostly, most of the songs were, actually a lot of them were about Natalie Portman, basically.
Really?
Yeah, I was obsessed. We did the entire Fiddler on the Roof soundtrack.
Yeah, and I was going to ask
you. Yeah,
about
right.
That.
So, and we cast it. So it had like guest stars and all this sort of stuff. And we were actually trying to get Natalie Portman on it. And this was when Ben Lee at the time was still dating Claire Danes, and Claire and Natalie were friends, and Ben was on the album, and Claire tried to help get Natalie on it, and it almost happened, except she we were recording in New York, and she had to be out off in LA.
No.
So it's like missed it by that much, you know.
It hurts. She was just doing a cameo, or she was.
She was just going. All we wanted
as herself.
That song, as herself. That song, Matchmaker, which is the second song in Fiddler on the Roof, we changed it to Matchmaker, an ode to Natalie Portman, and I reworded it to be about her. And all I wanted her at the end to say was something to the effect of "Not a chance" or something like that, but didn't happen.
Oh,
yeah,
it's a sad story.
Woe is me. How my life could have been different.
And how did writing the Book of Dirt begin?
It was. It's actually strange. I've always been writing. I've tried to write different. I've gotten started on a number of books, a large number of books. And what I found was always elements of my grandparents' story, or what I thought at the time was my grandparents' story, kept creeping in. And they always ended up being kind of Holocaust-y, even if it could have been a robot mice on Mars, and it still would have had some sort of element of my grandparents' story. And then that was in the background. And then a couple of years after my grandparents died, this article appears in the local Jewish paper. It purports to tell the Holocaust story that my grandfather was never able to tell himself. He was, it was quite common for Holocaust survivors not to tell their stories. They were essentially, firstly, traumatized into silence, but also they didn't want to kind of transmit trauma onto their particularly their families. So this article came out, and it said that my grandfather had been handpicked by the Nazis to be the literary curator of Hitler's Museum of the Extinct Race. And that to me was like mind-blowing, and it was so far at odds with what I thought his story was. And because I'm really bad at letting things rest, I was like, I need to know what the truth. And so given that I already had this need to sort of exercise, as in exorcise, the demons of my grandparents' stories on the page,
never in musical form?
Well, it's weird, actually. We definitely did some songs that were, like, our last album, which was called They Tried to Kill Us, They Failed, Let's Eat, right? And that's like the classic kind of Jewish slogan about every Jewish holiday is basically, they tried to kill us, they failed, let's eat. And the actual song, They Tried to Kill Us, is about, Jewish survival through, the Holocaust and adversity and, 2,000 years of oppression, etc. I think I dealt with aspects of it through there, but never directly their experience. And actually, weirdly, I reckon had the article never come out, I probably would have written something that was completely different, firstly, to Book of Dirt, but it would have been like Holocaust-ish because I needed to engage with my grandparents and their unspoken history. But it would have had none of the elements that I found in this quest because I would have had no idea that I was looking for them. I would have probably been satisfied with the version of their stories I thought I knew before the article came out. Yeah. So
You started to investigate post.
Yes.
The article came out, then you started saying,
So the article came out, and actually it probably took a few years before I really started investigating because the article came out right when the band started taking off. And so it was just something that I had in the back of my mind that I would look at. And it happened that we were doing our last tour of Israel. And I said to the guys, I'm just like, look, you guys go home afterwards. I want to look into a few things that I've been meaning to for years. In the book, the article happens and then I go on the search. So I've changed things in the book, just time scaling, because no one wants to read about the 5-year intervening years where, Bram was running around naked on a stage screaming into a rubber chicken.
Don't know.
Maybe in another, at least not in this book. Right? That's the next book. No.
Sequel.
Yeah, that's right. So I began looking after that last tour, and that's when I went to Yad Vashem, which is the main Holocaust museum in Israel, and Beit Terezin, which is this weird little museum on a kibbutz up in the north. That's kind of how I began. And I actually didn't really think it would be a book initially. I was just doing it for myself, just to do the search, and I was keeping just notes of my search for myself. And then the fewer answers I was getting, the more obsessed I became with knowing. And I came back to Australia and I thought, look, I'm not getting anything from the records, so I might as well start thinking about them as fictional characters. And I started writing, you know, this story of this, you know, young guy who's the son of a rabbi in a little village in what's now the Ukraine in the Carpathian Mountains, who runs off to Prague to in search of a bigger secular education, which is essentially what happened to my grandfather. And what would it be like for this little country boy to appear in this big city? And, you know, his entire world was this kind of religious Jewish world. And suddenly he was in the great, very, for its time, modern, cosmopolitan city of Prague. And that's how kind of the book got started.
And so the book merges fact and fiction, doesn't it?
Yes.
So there is a history of this kind of docu-fiction. Like, who do you...
Documentary fiction.
Where does your... Where do you derive inspiration from in that sort of
This is interesting
sense?
Because I never intended to take that form. What happened was I was collecting... Like, the search actually did start bearing fruit, and I did start... I was getting documents, I was getting photos, I was getting records. But at the same time, the fictional stuff was coming along really well. And I really had no idea how to tell the story. And like, I mean, documentary fiction is it's a movement. It's the use of real life documents, photos, records, et cetera, as narrative devices. And you know, it's often linked with historical fiction. And the real classic of it is Sebald, W.G. Sebald. And like, you know, everyone says to me, oh, is he a big influence? And like, I'd read him, but he wasn't. What actually really struck me was I happened to be in London. My brother was living there at the time, and I was in Hatchards. And there was just this spine on the shelf that, for absolutely no reason that I will ever be able to explain, jumped out at me. It's just beige, and it just got little red writing on the thing, and it was Dasha Drindich, Trieste. I just pulled it off the shelf and I looked and I started flicking, and it's this thing with, like, I read the first chapter. It's this woman waiting for her son, who she thought was dead, to arrive. And then I looked through and it's got all these photos in it and documents. It's got these lists of names and all that. Like, I thought, this is weird. So I bought it. I sat and I spent the next day like in a cafe reading this entire book, and it opened up the world of how you can blend fact and fiction, engaging with both and making them kind of mingle in a kind of interesting way, in a way that I never thought possible. Even having read, like, everyone says Sebald is the, you know, is the kind of the god of documentary fiction. And he's incredible, like he is. But like, I wasn't struck by it as something that would work for me until I read Dasha Drindich.
Right. And so are the stories that have generally, or the books that have generally had that documentary fiction format, do they tend to be deep stories? Like,
yeah, look, I mean, ones that's, so there's that Edouard Louis, the French writer, there's a book, his not his most recent book, the one before, it's called something like The History of Violence or something like that. And it's his story of he was raped in a toilet somewhere, and he had to engage with his, like, the reality of having been raped. And it's an incredibly powerful book, right? And he uses, like, that mixes the facts and fiction and documents as well. And like, another one which really I think has been quite successful and prominent in the movement is a book called The Dinner Guest by Gabriela Ibarra, and she is, I think she's Chilean, and they were basically at, her family was at dinner. Her grandfather was like a political agitator or something like that. And basically a gang turned up, came through the door, like rang the bell. They went to answer the door, they came, they arrested him, took him away, disappeared. And he was found dead a while later. And she's got like all photos. She's got like photos of his when they found his body. It's very confronting. But it's, you know, it really uses the documents and the historical, I guess, waypoints to guide the narrative and to you know, for the arc to be able to follow it.
Because within the Book of Dirt, there's a moment where, I mean, you are a kind of a character.
Yes.
You are yourself.
Inept,
but you're
hopeless
also...
researcher, Bram. Pretty accurate to fiction.
There's a moment where you tell a story, you have a fictionalized account of what happens to a particular character, and then you sort of make the comment that, but actually, in real life, that character doesn't exist. I made him up.
Yeah.
Is that a common thing to happen in?
No. Right. So the reason I did that was because, so one of the great mysteries of that sort of remains even after having finished the book, in these letters that my grandmother sent her mother from concentration camp to Prague, because my great-grandmother was a convert, so the Nazis didn't consider her a Jew, so they didn't arrest her, they didn't take her, whereas my grandmother, whose father was Jewish, was taken. She keeps referring to this Mr. B. And Mr. B was the person who was, I suppose, the conduit for smuggled goods to get into the camp to keep my grandmother and her sister alive. And I really became obsessed with trying to work out who Mr. B was. And my great uncle, he has since died, but at the time I was researching, he was the only person still alive from that generation. And he says that he remembered my grandmother and his wife, my grandmother's sister, talking about this Mr. B, and his name was Bohush, and that Bohush was someone who lived on the street. So I had this idea that I needed a family and Bohush had to be someone from this family. The family itself has to disappear, and there's no record of them because, slight spoiler alert, you know, the parents do disappear.
But you do say up front that everything.
Oh, yeah. Like, everyone's dead, basically. Everyone's dead, including the ones I made up. So I just, with Bohush, I wanted to make it clear that, and I think this was kind of important for what I was trying to do, that while I was engaged in this search, I wasn't going to find answers. And where I needed the answers to be filled for the purposes of the story in the fictionalized part of the book, I wanted to be upfront about it. And that actually came, that really came from something that Arnold Zabel told me. I was really struggling with this fact fiction divide, and, you know, I didn't want to be hoodwinking the readers. And Arnold said, you just have to be honest. You have to be transparent, be clear, and say, I am actually making this up. And he said in one of his early books, he had these kind of flights of imagination. That book was also a kind of family search one. And he said, like in the book, he explicitly says, and now I am imagining blah, 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 blah. And I think he's right. Like, I think it's very important to be transparent about that, particularly when you're purporting to tell a historical story that you're suggesting has some sort of accuracy. And that's why, like, the parts in the book that are magical realist, they're so clearly made up that I didn't want people to think that they were a belief that I had in them really happening. Because what's interesting is a lot of the stories that make up the kind of narrative of both my grandfather and my grandmother's stories were dramatizations of things that were told to me. So even though it's fiction, in inverted commas, that part of the book, it's really like it's a fictionalization of either what I was told happened or from the evidence I found what I believe happened, other than obviously the very clear flights of fancy I take with magical realist stuff.
Do you think that those ethical considerations were more important because it was a family story? Or do you think
I think it was, it was, they were more important because it's a Holocaust story.
Yeah.
I think that's, and this is a really difficult area at the moment. So the book that is always held up as the problematic one is The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, right? And, you know, hugely successful, but minimizes, sanitizes. Mm. And the problem with books getting huge popular currency, Holocaust books getting huge popular currency and getting it wrong, is that they become the common narrative of what the Holocaust was. And so we're only two generations from people going, yeah, it wasn't that bad. Mm. Do you know what I mean? So I think when it comes to writing books that deal with the Holocaust, and interestingly, I actually don't strangely consider my book a Holocaust book. For me, it's just that's the context, a book about how we tell stories and how we come to know the people we love was set, because that happens to be my family story. But because it was, and because I was writing about the Holocaust, I just felt this really intense need to get it right. You can go wherever you want in terms of creative embellishments and whatever, as long as you don't claim things that aren't true to be true, and as long as you get all your basic facts, I suppose, right. And a really good example for this was when I was in the editorial process, editing process. I need my editor to tell me which word was right. during that process, my editor, Penny, she said to me, This section, this there's an episode where my great grandmother goes to Theresienstadt and visits her daughters. And she said, no one could visit a concentration camp. What are you talking about? And I said, well, that's the story that I've been told. She goes, find me evidence or this isn't going in the book. And I did a lot of research and I found, and bearing in mind that Theresienstadt, while certainly no walk in the park, was, you know, as many a survivor has said to me, it was heaven next to Auschwitz, right? And I found records of people who did actually turn up. And there's a great one, which I actually was the one I gave to Penny. There was a guy whose housekeeper was Jewish and she was taken to Theresienstadt. And he wanted to visit her. He went to the camp. He walked through the front gates. He got as far as the commandant's office. And he went to the commandant of a concentration camp. And he said, I want to see my housekeeper. I want to meet up with her. Security was called and he was escorted out. But the point being, people did get in and people... So as far as I knew and the story I was told was they met at the fence. So I wasn't going to go any further than that. But I did write an episode where they meet at the fence. I think any sort of... particularly areas that people haven't heard of before, you need to know that if you're ever questioned about it, you have the evidence to show that these things could and did happen.
So you started writing the book. You know, it sounds like a lot of things were happening in parallel in terms of how it was written. There was a short story, Crumbs, that you submitted to the Age short story comp. Was that part...
Yes,
a section of the book of
So that's Dirt. The prologue. That became an edited version of that, a slightly altered version of that is the prologue to the Book of Dirt. What happened was, Crumbs is the part where a rabbi's son in the Carpathian Mountains flees to it, and Crumbs finishes when he leaves the village, right? As does the prologue. And this being my grandfather. And it was the first thing I wrote when I decided to fictionalize the stories. And I remember I wrote two stories that year. I still remember the other one and I still like the other. Anyway, I sent the two of them in and I thought nothing of it. Like,
were you allowed to enter two?
Yeah, you could. You could actually, I think you could enter three, I think it was. But I'm not prolific enough to have three, but I had two. And so I sent these two stories and I remember, like, just out of the blue, the phone rings and I'm like, is this Bram Presser? I'm like, yeah, it's Jason Steger. I'm like, oh, hi. Did you submit a story called Crumbs? I'm like, yeah. To the Age Short Story Award? I said, yes. He goes, well, you've won. And I kind of paused for a moment. I said, what was wrong with the other one? I was like so kind of like blown away that I was like, but that's also like the classic Jewish joke of, you know, your mother gives you two ties, the red and the blue one, and you wear the red one. She goes, no, what's wrong with the blue one? So that's my default logic. So that one and that kind of, for me, it was actually more than anything, just the validation that maybe I could actually write, you know? So, and also maybe people would be interested in the story that I've been pursuing, that it is actually more than just a short story. It is the book.
And so once you had a finished manuscript, what did you do?
So I never had a finished manuscript.
Oh, okay.
So what happened was after the short story award, I was speaking to a couple of publishers who were interested if
really?
I had anything more. You know,
they contact you well, on the back
it,
of that week.
Well, I was put in contact with is a better way of putting it. And I had this thing where I have, since I was quite young, been a huge fan of text. And I had this thing that my dream as a writer was to be published by text. And if they ever made an offer, I would stop talking to whoever else I was talking to and I would just take it and I could not care less if it was, you know, a tiny fraction of what someone else was offering. They publish so many of the authors that I love, right?
Fabulous books.
Yes. And so, and to have that little T like meant a lot to me, right? So I just remember I was talking with Penny, who was my editor. And then one day she kind of, they made an offer and I said, oh, I wasn't expecting that. And she goes, well, we're not talking as friends, you know, there is actually a business here too. Like, even though we got on very well. So I was probably only about a third of the way into the book at that point.
Wow.
And I had, in the contract negotiations, I had this obsession that I wanted my book published before I was 40. And that gave me, to allow that, I was 38 at the time, right? So to allow that, I had to have the book finished within 6 months of signing the contract.
Yep.
Bear in mind, I'd only had a third of the book done and very little of the research. And I, like, after I signed, I went into, like, complete creative paralysis and I couldn't write a word. And I didn't write for ages. And it came to, so the thing was December, the deadline. Came to, like, late November and I was curled up in a ball, catatonic, crying. Like, I was a complete breakdown. My poor partner, like, God bless her that she stood by me for even a day of that, let alone that she's actually still there. But at the end, I came to the point where I was prepared to walk away from the contract. I called Penny, I asked to meet. We had coffee and I said, look, this isn't going to happen. I can't write anything. The book's going nowhere. My deadline's in 2 weeks. But she cracks up laughing because no one thought you'd meet that deadline. 6 months, are you kidding? Like, you know, she said, just take a break and come back when you're ready and we'll pick it up where we left off. And I just remember I still couldn't write for quite a while. And then like 16 months later, it was my 40th birthday and I just got and I did this thing where I was avoiding texts like the plague because I was too scared to face them. I began by, send the occasional email and say, you know, I'm still here. Yeah, exactly. I'm in recovery, except whatever. I remember my 40th birthday, after having not spoken to her for about 8 months, I got an email from Penny and it just said, hi, Bram, happy birthday. Now you're 40, get over it and write the bloody book. And amazingly, it worked. And it happened to coincide with, I got a fellowship at Glenfern, which is like this beautiful Gothic mansion that Writers Victoria have, strangely quite close to where I live. It's in St Kilda. And I just, you know, I got in there and I literally just started writing and it started working. I by this point, I actually collected a lot more evidence. I just hadn't, like records and photos. I just hadn't done anything with it yet. And so I was just like, it just started working. And there's a kind of running joke in Glenfern that if you're in room 3, that's the finishing room. And I happened to, for the second bit, like my first room, I was in room 7, which I'm still in now, but
long did the fellowship go for?
So it only went for 3 months, but then I stayed on. You can stay on as you can actually pay. It's you know, it's amazing. Like if you can be there, it's great. It's very affordable for studio space, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a beautiful community of writers. I had to move studios. I moved into 3 and I finished in 3. And it's hilarious because I think like Lucy Trelaw finished her Salt Creek in 3.
Right.
Leah Kaminsky finished her first book in 3. Lee Kaufman finished a book in 3. Good, it's hilarious.
Advice. Yeah. Get room
and
3.
So I'm in 7 and I'm like, you know, working on the new book. But when I really feel like I'm in the home stretch, I'm moving into room 3 because I know
that. Do you get a say on what room
not? You can request. Yeah. You can request. But rooms, like the room I'm in is a lot. Room 3 is quite small. Room 7's big and it's a great place to lay out all your research and all that and what have you.
Yep. So it's your own room.
Yes.
Too. Yep. No one else in there.
Yeah. It's brilliant. Yeah. Just me and the, you know, possum that climbs in the window sometimes.
So once you had actually finished the manuscript, once the book came out,
yeah,
a lot of people, a lot of authors find that author public persona side of things very difficult.
Yeah.
Do you think your music background has helped with that?
Absolutely. Like I love performing. But what's weird though is like when I think about the way I performed in the band, and it was really like, you know, degrees of ridiculousness. You know, how far can you actually push it?
There's a lot of hummus.
There was a lot of hummus. embarrassingly, if you Google my name and put Yidcore and then do an image search, one of the first ones that comes up is me half naked, covered in hummus, holding a rubber chicken. And I always remember saying to Penny when the book was about to be released, I go, we should, you know, get the whole punk thing, like we should build on it. She said, no, like you're being like you're a proper author now, like, you know, like. And I said, yeah, but if anyone Googles me, you can't escape it. You might as well embrace it. So I think like I love performing. And what's weird though, I actually feel a lot more naked, albeit not covered in hummus, talking about writing, because it's just so much more personal. And I really struggle sometimes, like particularly on like when I'm on panels or I get asked a curly question, I freeze up because I'm so deeply embedded in this whole world of my book. that it becomes, and I think that, you know, oh no, I think I have to say something profound now. Do you know what I mean? And people, I think, expect me to have something to say about certain things. And yeah, I do. I freeze up. But that said, like, I also, like, you know, I like moseying onto stage and gripping the microphone and, you know, sitting there. I just did Adelaide Writers Week, which was great. And I had my matching, I had a watermelon shirt and avocado socks. No, broccoli socks. I was like, no one else apparently got the memo that the fruit was there, how to get vegetables was the way to get dressed. No, but it's like, look, you can't look like I look and not have like a, you know, embrace the performative aspect of doing these things. And it's great fun. Like I and the fact that people, you know, are willing to listen to you or talk to you, yeah, it's good, and it's such a strange thing thinking of these. They really are the same thing, the two modes of performance, but they're just like the rarefied version and the complete gutter version. But they're just the same thing, and you've got to enjoy it. That's the other thing. Like, it's very easy to get kind of caught up in the stress of it and what have you. But at the end of the day, panels or in conversations and all that, they're actually performances, right? And like, I'm on the programming committee of Melbourne Jewish Book Week. And we always, when we're programming, like, we're always talking about, like, people come to book like festivals and what have you. And they do go there to learn things and to become, you know, immerse themselves in the culture and what have you. But they also want to be entertained. Mm. Like, these things should still be entertaining. Because I've gone and seen writers I love and they've been boring as crap, right? Whereas I've also seen authors who I barely knew, they were amazing, and I went off and I bought all their books, you know, because that's what they had to say and how they said it made me think, well, this is someone that I want to see on a page and spend time with.
Do you think what you have had to say about the book has changed across the period of time that it's been out?
Yeah, I think it has. I think at the beginning I was just in shock mostly, and I didn't know what to expect in terms of questions. And I think that has changed such that, like, and what's weird is because the book got released in America a year after it got released in Australia. And so I had to start talking about it again as if it were new. And what's weird when you're doing that is you get asked the same questions you were being asked when they were new. And I think I answered them a lot better the second time around. And the only downside is you do tend to have go-to stories or go-to kind of phrases that, you know, you hope not too many people hear too many of your interviews or read too many of your interviews because they go, oh, he's using that bloody line again. Like, does he have anything interesting to say anymore? Is he just on autopilot?
I do know that feeling. It's like telling the same joke all the time. Like,
but what's weird though is like, that's no different to playing music because you're playing the same songs, right? And I think maybe that's been good for me that I had to find, because I was, you know, if I was touring and we had, you know, 2 weeks playing every night and you're playing the same set list and like, you have to find new things in them to make them interesting to perform for you. So I think that was actually a really good training ground for talking about the book. The problem with repeating like phrases and stories is there are sometimes you'll come out with something you're like, I'm pretty glad I just said that. Like, I'm pretty proud of that comment. And you know that's going straight into the pocket.
I totally know what you mean.
Yeah. You can't avoid it though, can you? Like, and the thing is, there's only so many ways you can answer a question without like being stupid about it and like not answering it.
I think it's also life. Like, something interesting happens to you, you do tell that story 10 times that
absolutely
week, you know?
Yeah.
It's sort
or
of
if you're my daughter every 2 minutes. But yeah. She's two, I should add, at this point. But like,
now, you've had a lot of critical success with this book. You've won a lot of awards for it. We'll start with what's great about that. And we might see if there are any downsides.
It's really strange. Look, it took me 8 years to write, and I'd lost all perspective on whether the book was any good, whether, you know. And like, when the first review came out and it was good, I'm like, okay. And then the more review, and they were like, it got good reviews. And then awards happened, and it's so incredibly again validating for. It justifies 8 years of existential hell, basically. And to know that, A, it was worth going on that quest, and B, that I actually like have something to say that people might want to hear. And that I can, in a craft sense, that I seem to be able to do it, you know, competently. And, you know, because I love writing as a craft as well. And so when I hear someone talk about the writing, that's very gratifying. Look, you know, just the recognition is great. Even and this is anyone who publishes a book, even if your book like were to do nothing, the first time you see it on a shelf is actually the greatest thing in the world, right? And then if you happen to see it on a stack in a bookshop, then you're like, okay, wow. Or if you see it in a window, you're like, oh my God. Like, and then, you know, and it's getting reviews. Like, it's just, it's such a beautiful feeling. And then the awards, it's just, I don't know, like it actually continues to kind of render me speechless because I still can't quite grasp that this thing I've written has won a number of awards. And it's like my first book. Mm. It's just, it's weird. And, but it's amazing. Like you can, and like, it sounds so crass to say this, but like the money is actually really helpful as well when you win awards, because like writing is not something you do to, that you're not going to retire on your royalties. And maybe if you write popular fiction, you are. But if you're writing literary fiction, you know, it ain't. And so just to give you a bit of breathing room and to actually go, okay, now I can, this allows me to spend time working on the next thing. You know, that's amazing. Mm. I don't have to scrounge for space the way I might have otherwise had to had it not won an award. So, yeah, that's like, you know, that's been incredible as well. Look, I can't put into words how kind of great it all is. It's been incredible. And it's very humbling as well to think that someone has actually thought of your book as worthy of recognition.
It's probably a good segue into the second book.
Oh. That's the downside, isn't it? One of the downsides.
So do you have a two-book contract? Is that how
it... No, I've got an option. It's a one book and an option. And look, I mean, I shouldn't be laying my cards on the table
like this. Keep them to your chest.
However, I will anyway. But lucky this is just an audio thing. Otherwise, people would see me with an arm like shoved up my back. And I think like I've had an amazing experience with text, and so like I would hope that they want the next book, and I hope that it's a good book, and you know, we'll see what happens.
And do you start with a theme? Do you start
with a character? So I actually had a weird thing. Like I had this image of an event, and I wanted to kind of think about what it would be like for people who witnessed it and were part of this event. And it's just like it's in a small rural village, right? It happens, and I realize it is actually, in some ways, it's a companion piece to Book of Dirt. Not in any sense. There's no Holocaust in it. You know, it's not a family quest and all that. But it is about memory. It's about identity. Mm. It's about how we tell stories. So they're the things that I'm most interested in. So, you know, I will revisit them. And, you know, this, thankfully, is also, as I see it, a lot shorter. I think it's a fable. I think it'll be about half as long as Book of Dirt, and it's purely drawn from the imagination. So yeah, I just kind of have been going with the flow and like I was actually stressing really badly about, oh my God, second book. How can I write something worthy of following up Book of Dirt? And also, you know, do people want me to write another documentary fiction piece? Or if I don't write it, are people going to abandon me going, oh, well, that's what I liked about him. So there's all these neuroses that get brought up. But I think...
Did you have them in music, by the way?
I suppose so. Like, there was always that question of, do I have more to say? And that's why the band ended when it did as well. Like, our last album, I think, was our best. And at that point, I felt I'd said what I wanted to say, and I was happy to walk away from it. So we were able to kind of finish on a high. Also because, you know, we were our mid-30s then, and there comes a point at which, you know, traveling around the world, sleeping on concrete floors and, you know, getting paid nothing to, you know, and eating two-minute noodles every night becomes a bit of a pain. But yeah, like I probably didn't have it in the same way with, like, I always wanted the next album to be better. It was easier to do because it's collaborative as well. You know, you're all egging each other on. You all get better together. I think I became a better lyricist as it went on. With writing, it's just because you want to do something. And I was actually, it was funny. I gave actually the first two chapters of this new book to Penny to just have a look at. And I was worried because it's different, right? It's clear if you read Book of Dirt that I love writing fables because there's lots of fables in the book.
Yeah, fables are great.
But to say that an entire book is going to be a fable and it's completely different in style. And Penny was like, oh, I'm so relieved you're doing something different. And I was like, oh, amazing. Like, and she goes, she loved it. And she's like, this is great. Like, keep it. So that was like a really big, I had this moment of decompression, you know, the stress kind of went away. It's hard still, you know, actually sitting down and writing. Finding the time to write it is actually really hard. That's the one thing you don't get told about having a book that goes all right. Like, you actually don't have much time. And so this expectation that you are going to be able to create something new is kind of goes out the window. And that's really frustrating. But also, like, when stressing about the second book, like, I realized, speaking to other writers who all said to me, basically, you know, just accept this as part of the process. Second book sucks, right? And then there was a couple of authors who said, and if it makes you feel any better, it doesn't get better for third or fourth. But second is apparently, you know, the hardest. Because I've actually had this enforced space, it's actually allowed me to let the kind of ideas percolate a bit. And I actually, weirdly, on the way back from America just last week, I can't sleep on planes, right? So my brain goes off on strange journeys. And I realized where the rest of this new book will go. And I quickly jotted down. And they're just plot points. I'm not a big planner. I have general plot points of where I want it to go. And then I'm happy to let it take me where it takes me. Most of the time I'll return to those points. But sometimes I'll just like, no, where it's gone is better. Chuck it out. Right. Yeah. I've come back. Going,
so it's like you're,
I think,
ready.
Yeah, I am. I'm actually really excited to do it. And downside is I have to travel again in May and probably again in November. I still also want to have time with my family and actually just to have a bit of a rest and what have you. So, you know, but that's, I have very first world writer problems, I have to say. Like, I feel like such an absolute
dick. It's a hard balance to strike, though.
It is, though. Yeah, it is. I mean, like,
it's the reality.
You don't want to complain about it because, like, I wouldn't have it any other way. And like, I've been incredibly fortunate and I've had a bit of a dream run. But I can't pretend that there isn't a downside that, you know, I don't have time to write and I don't really have time to properly, you know, spend with, you know, my partner and kid. Well,
on that note.
Yes. I'm very cheery. Yeah. That's not sad.
Advice for a first-time author?
You know what? Like, it's, I think it's one of the, at the end of the day, you just have to believe in yourself. Like, it's, you can show it to whoever you want. Firstly, if you do show it to people, don't show it to people who are just going to tell you it's good. Right? That's like number one. And, you know, show your vulnerable parts. If you're confident that a part of what you're writing is really good, but you're not sure about another, don't show the really good part. Show the,
that's true.
You know, like, I think people, I did one of those masterclass things, and you know, it was a writing group, and everyone had to bring in samples of their work, and you could tell who was there to essentially show off, and who was there who really wanted help, and I think it's very important that if you are seeking help, to be willing to show what needs help, rather than just kind of. Look, that said, I think there are some people who it's probably very important to just get the validation of telling them they're great.
I think at times that's what you need, but I think it's an evolution. It's my sort of take. I remember workshopping at the start and being much more, it was a much more polished piece, but now I think I'm much more, this isn't working.
Yeah. I think I'm sort of the same. And actually, when I was workshopping, I actually completely rewrote a chapter. That I think is actually now a very strong chapter in the book, because I knew it wasn't working. The group helped me understand why. They didn't like show me what to do to fix it, but like it gave me an understanding. And then I, like, for the second week of the workshopping, I'd rewritten it, and everyone was like, "Yeah, okay, this is now working." And I could feel it. I could feel it straight away as well. So yeah, and I think just like take your time. There's this kind of weird feeling that you need to rush it to completion or that. But like
get it published before you're 40.
Yeah, well, exactly. That I think that was like one of the greatest hurdles or obstacles that I had to actually finishing the book. This obsessive need to finish it at a particular time. Like it was, like looking back, it was ridiculous. And yes, I would have loved to have, because you know I always had this, you know, get the law degree before I was X, get my PhD before I was Y, get my, you know, put out 5 albums by the, et cetera. And I failed most of those things, right? But like the book one was a big one for me.
Yeah.
But it was actually, looking back, it was really silly. Like, why?
That's it. Thanks, Bram, for being on the show.
Thank you. It was great.
This is the first time Quick Five with Bram Presser, and you are allowed to pass on any question. So for your first time, agented or unagented?
Unagented.
Advance or no advance?
Modest advance.
Overseas territories or just Australia, New Zealand?
Overseas for the first time.
Festival invites or no festival invites?
This is my great bugbear and disappointment. I'm not really on the... I've done a bit of festival stuff, but I'm not really on the radar. I'm not the zeitgeisty kind of guy that gets all the invites, but that's all right. You know.
Copies sold?
I think for literary fiction, it sold reasonably well, but I'm not, you know, banking my daughter's college fund on it.
And what is your favourite novel by a debut author?
I think all time it would have to be The Tenant by Roland Topor, which was made into a great Roman Polanski film. And of recent times, Australian, The Everlasting Sunday by Robert Lukens.
Oh, good recommendation.
Thank you.
To find out more about Bram or to check out the show notes, go to thefirsttimepodcast.com or get in touch via Twitter or Instagram at thefirsttimepod.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast, a podcast about the first and second time you publish a book. We recorded this episode at RMIT University on the traditional land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. This podcast is produced by Phoebe 80. The First Time Podcast is supported by Writers Victoria, ACT Writers Centre, RMIT School of Media and Communication, and by our wonderful supporters on Patreon. You too can become a supporter of our podcast by heading to our Patreon site, www.patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast.